everybody. It's Dana. Welcome to the Collective Table and to another awesome episode. Today, Chelsea and I welcome pastor and writer Trey Ferguson. Trey's new book is Theologizing Bigger, Homilies on Living Freely and Loving Holy, and it is ready for you to read. So go grab a copy. Trey is a pastor, a writer, a podcaster. He's a theologian in action. And in this book, you're going to really learn about his life and how theology is everywhere and we're doing it all the time. We are excited for you to engage with the conversation. If you're not following Trey or you don't know about his work, please check out his website at Pastor Trey, that's TREY05.com, or follow him on social media. Stay tuned. Here it goes. All right, Collective Table, we are here today with Trey Ferguson. Theologizing Bigger, Homilies on Living Freely and Loving Holy. We are super excited you're here, super excited to tell everybody about this book and just wanting to get the word out. So can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how the book came to be? Like, how did it come into life?
Yeah, most definitely. First and foremost, I'm so grateful to be here. I really appreciate the space that you've cultivated here. And not only that, I know that you very much take seriously the responsibility to the people that you have in this community. My publisher ran by some of the questions that you guys asked and vetted me and everything. And I really appreciated that. And so I feel safe here because I know that you prioritize the safety of the people here. And I think I come by that appreciation because I know what it's like to feel unsafe, right? Like, that's part of my story. I've grown up in church and around church for my entire life. It's not to say that I've always felt targeted or unsafe, but I do know what it's like. And the book talks about it some, not being able to feel like I can bring my whole self to the table. And that product of that process of growing and regular human development and things of that nature, I go through regular stages like everybody else. So there's the process of questioning my faith, questioning God and all of those things, even though I don't know if I've ever gone through an official phase of identifying as an agnostic or anything. But there was a time where I wasn't going to church regularly. I went to an aggressively secular university for college, the University of Miami, and I don't regret that at all or anything, but it's around that time where I followed this young lady I was attracted to back into the church, and I developed a new relationship with my faith. And in that process, I made sure that there was room for me and all of my questions in whatever room I went to, right? And if there was not room for me and my questions, I wouldn't be there, right? And so I talk some in my book about how I dropped out of my first seminary when I realized that it was causing me to sacrifice too much and everything. And so that really shapes the way that I try to show up, not only in the world, but in the ministry. And when I talk about God and when I talk to people about God, when I'm leading in communities of faith, I want to make sure that I'm cultivating a space that is safe for the fullness of who people are.
I think you said something. One, I appreciate the courage and the bravery, because I think there's lots of people who are not in spaces where they can question, wrestle, and feel comfortable asking those questions. And it sounds like you were able to see those spaces and say, okay, this isn't for me.
Yeah, most definitely. I'm real quick to leave. And I come by that, honestly, my father was a dude who didn't really feel the need for validation. You weren't going to pressure him into being somewhere where he didn't feel welcomed or anything like that, right? So I know he ran into issues with the administration in school. He dropped out of high school, right? Not because he couldn't cut it. He got into an Ivy League university even after having dropped out of high school and things like that. And when he didn't feel as though he could be the fullness of himself somewhere, he would dip. And so one of the things that I inherited from my father is that if these people cannot appreciate you for the totality of who you are, they don't really deserve your presence, right?
Amen, amen.
We do get into trouble with that in the church. Like, you were naming the fear of saying, I have these questions, or I don't quite agree. That doesn't sit well with me. So how do you, in your work, how do you combat that? Like, how do you actually create space where people feel safe, seen, valued, all the things you were looking for?
You know, this is paradox wherein the more committed I become, or the more committed I am in any given moment to doing that work within the confines of an institution, right? Because I do believe in the local church. I do believe there's value there. But the tougher it becomes to cultivate those spaces, because a lot of times they're already set in what is and is not proper. And so for me personally, when I enter a space that may already have some boundaries there, first and foremost, I'm a provocateur of my nature. I'm going to find out how close I can get to the edge before things become problematic for myself and others. But then also, for me, it starts with the affirmation of your worth, even apart from this institution. Letting you know that your value is not found by how closely you adhere to whatever mores we have here, that your value is found in the very nature of your being. The fact that you are still drawing breath is what makes you worthy of respect, of love, of admiration, even, you know, all of these things. And when we can ground your worth in your being, as opposed to the institutions that only exist because of a bunch of beings coming together, then I think that there is room for us to draw a little more confidence in bringing more of ourselves to the table. Hmm. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, that was really well said. I think there is this confusion between the institution has to accept me for God to accept me. I have to adhere to these rules, right, and these boundaries and say these things or I'm cast out. And while that's true of some institutions, right, you are cast out if you don't adhere, it's never true of God. And so the distinction between those things is really important that I think you're naming.
Yeah, I'll go to my grave believing that some people will need to leave their churches or leave their communities in order to find God. And I think that's a biblically grounded idea, right? Like there are times where God calls people out of certain situations in order to find the full essence of who God is and what God is like.
You know, one of the things that Chelsea and I wrestle with even now is, what does the church really even look like in the long term? You have more and more individuals identifying as spiritual, but not religious, and right, leaving the local church. So does the church evolve into something that we don't even think about, as today? It's not this institutionalized location that you physically go to. Does it become something different?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room to explore that question. And because, first and foremost, I don't think that the church is primarily supposed to be an institution in the way that we think of it. I think it becomes that because things are crystallized. That's the nature of societies. Like, as relationships develop, they are formalized. What we recognize today as the institution of marriage was not always so. What we recognize as the institution of the nation state was not always so, right? And the church, likewise, has become something. And I don't know that the institutions and the organizational structures are as essential to the idea of the church, this redemptive thing that Jesus is coming back for, as a lot of us would like to present it as, right? And again, this is me. I'm somebody who is a part of the local church, but I recognize that a lot of that is just an inherited tradition. And that's not to denigrate any of that. It's to acknowledge the reality of what it is. But at the same time, if what Jesus says is that where two or three are gathered in my name, I'm in the midst, then we have to recognize what constitutes a church is not necessarily the hierarchy, but the presence of the Spirit, right? So if there are a handful of people who decided they want to meet at a Buffalo Wild Wings twice a month and check in on each other and pray together, and at some point they say the little prayer and recognize the body and the blood of Jesus among them, and it is remembered in there, then they've just started a church in the middle of a Buffalo Wild Wings. That's how that goes.
That is so good. I love that. Yes! Yes, yes, yes. So let's get back to the book. I want to talk about, how did the book come about? And you coined the term theologizing. Can you talk a little, you actually say in the intro, it's an action. You can't theologize without breaking a sweat. Can you talk more about this? Tell us how this all came out. Like, where does this book come from?
Yeah, it's funny. So I talk about theologizing a lot because it's the way that my brain works on a natural basis, right? If you ask me what I do for a living, right? Like, if people ask me where I am, I say, oh, I talk about God. Right. And so in the local church context, I'm the executive pastor at the Refuge Church, whatever. But then there's also this other part that is just as much a part of my vocation, where I literally just talk about God with people. I am a public theologian, is the actual term right there. Right. And the school of theology that I do is constructive theology. Some people will put lots of different labels on or whatever. But this action of theologizing isn't just a matter of me knowing doctrines and propagating those things. I'm consistently wrestling with the revelation of God in real time. That's what I do. I try to make sense of the world around us in light of what I believe is the reality of God and the intervention of God here and now. And so there are theologians who their primary work is studying the patristics, right? They want to study the patriarchs, or they'll study the reformers and all these things, and they'll make sense of this. And that's fine. Like, I have the credentials. I could do that. I don't really find, like, Katie Cannon says, you have to pursue the work that your soul must have. I don't find fulfillment in that realm of thinking. I got to get my hands dirty. I need to make things plain for people in a way that I feel that some theologians do not feel empowered to do. And so this idea of theologizing is really me trying to find God in the crevices of all that there is in the lives that we live from day to day. I believe that John Calvin or Karl Barth or whoever has wonderful insights to give us in the character of God. But what do those insights say to us right here and right now about what we're going through? And that's a question that is ever evolving, because we never live the same day twice in a row. And so theologizing is how I make sense of God, the infinite God, becoming finite in the person of Jesus Christ in a human life like the ones we live. What does that look like on a regular basis? It's an active task, and it's an action. I talk about, like, oh, you can't do this without breaking a sweat, because you never get to rest from theologizing. We're always developing. We're always growing. It's never the same 2 days in a row.
When you're theologizing, it sounds to me like you're trying to make, like, what theologians, like, kind of up here in their head, you're trying to make practical, accessible. Why does this matter? What does it mean? To who? Like, who's your audience? Who are you trying to, like, help see that?
Well, that's a phenomenal question, right? And that was a question I really had to wrestle with, because, you know, I just wrote a book. And when you're doing that, you got to go, you talk to agents or publishers or whoever, and you got to tell them, who is your primary audience? And I said, that is really tough for me to answer, because the answer to that question, if you ask me who I write for or who I make content for, is me. I make stuff that I think is, I make stuff that I think is going to be dope at the end of the day. And when I'm writing this book, when I'm writing Theologizing Bigger, I'm writing to that younger version of myself who wasn't sure where I could bring my questions. And I'm letting that version of me know that these questions are okay, that you're not less than, that your faith isn't weak right now, that you are a human and you are seeking, right? I'm affirming that person. Now, what I discovered in the process somewhere along the way, one of the blessings of social media, was that I realized that once upon a time, things that I might've thought I was going through by myself are a lot more universal than I'd given them credit for. Right. One amazing thing happened. I still can't all the way make sense of it. I just accept it for a reality at this point. One of the groups, if you break down demographically, right, like you got the age groups and the races and the socioeconomic statuses and all these things. One group that consistently connects with me at a higher clip than others is middle-aged white women, right? Middle class, middle-aged white women. And I can't really explain why that is, because I'm a dude growing up in large cities. I don't have my gold teeth in right now because it didn't seem appropriate for the setting. But no, I get it. I get down how I get down. But yeah, but for whatever reason, like, it's an audience that often finds some value in what I'm saying. And it confused me for a long time until I just accepted it for what it was, that a lot of the things that I'm going through are understandable by so many different sorts of people. And so when you ask me, like, who my audience is, it is people who have questions about God and do not want to feel uncomfortable about the presence of those questions anymore, regardless of who they might be or where they are in life. I want people who want to feel more comfortable being themselves in the presence of God. That's my audience.
And I think that is a growing edge in Christian world. Like, I feel like even when I was growing up, questions were meant to doubt God, and doubting was a sin. And, like, but now it seems there is a little bit more space or a little bit more freedom. Have you found that in your work? Does it feel like the questions are coming easier, or there's space for them?
Yeah, I think a lot of that is contextual, right? Because one of the things that the digital revolution has done is it has shrunk the world in so many different ways. We can get our hands on so many different perspectives in so much quicker of a way, right? I consistently posit that we're in something that is almost comparable to the Protestant Reformation, which was largely spurred on by the invention of the printing press. Just the speed at which information is disseminated changed the way the religion, that the Christian faith, was viewed. And I think that the internet, smartphone technology has done something very similar in our own time that we're still waking up to. At the same time, though, the Protestant Reformation did not kill the Eastern Orthodox and Catholic churches. Those traditions are still there. And they weren't left unimpacted by the advent of technology, but those traditions are still there. And I say all of that to say that there are some people who are still in places where they do not feel comfortable questioning, where they do not feel like those things are welcome yet, because as fast as the world is changing, it does not change at the same pace in everywhere, in every setting.
I mean, technology covers so many spaces. It'll be interesting to see how all of that evolves over time. And Christianity is so fragmented right now, and certainly in this country.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? They have the Timeline Variance Association, where there's like supposed to be one sacred timeline, but then all of these branches of things hop off and everything. I'm sorry, this is nerd talk right now. I see something happening similar in Christianity, where like we want to pretend it's this one thing, but there's so many different branches, right? There is no Christianity. There are Christianities, and all of these different things are happening right here. And I think it's worth wrestling with sometimes, like, was there ever supposed to be one of these things? Or do we take the words of Jesus seriously when Jesus says that other sheep have I who are not of this fold, you know?
So you use a lot of storytelling, which I love. I think it makes it very relatable. And I just, you know, hearing about you and hearing about your life, is there one story that just, probably not one because there's so many options, but like, is there one story that just stood out for you when you wrote the book, or something that just was storytelling just a natural part of your writing? Like, how did that?
I think for me, stories are meant to communicate and relay truths, right? And so there are divine truths, eternal truths that I will not understand until and unless it is put in a narrative form, and unless something I can relate to. And I think that's one of the reasons that Jesus speaks in so many parables, because there's power in storytelling. I think it's one of the things that we often lose, particularly in Western strains of Christianity, where we flatten the Bible as not a collection of literature, but as a collection of doctrines, things of that nature. I think we lose something in that. And so one of the things that I'm rather intentional about is reintroducing the power of story into our faith. And so if you ask, like, my favorite chapter to write, I can't even remember what number it was. I think it was 14 or 15, when I talk about living in the Matrix. And I relate it to the movie The Matrix. And what I'm doing there is trying to explain what the reality of sin is. Because we often ask things like, oh, is such and such a sin? Is such and such a sin? And if you look in the Bible, there's really not a lot of sins listed in that way. There are, like, certain lists of things. But no, sin is more of a concept. It's more of a reality. It's describing the reality of humanity here on earth, and that there is something standing between us and this indestructible concept of rightness, right? And that's what sin is. And that's tough for me to say in words like that, but it's easy for me to tell you in a story where, like, oh, no, you have to awaken to this reality, and you can choose to be blind to that, or you can awaken to it and then work to bring that system down.
And I think that's a great example, because sin is such a complicated and often contentious word. Again, going back to people, you know, who have been in and out of Christian experiences, they're like, sin. But yet, if you can bring it to a story and say, wait a minute, hold on, let me explain it this way, it becomes more relatable, and it doesn't necessarily become this awful. And maybe it still is an awful thing for some people, but at least I think you're conveying something that's more understandable than just this word sin.
Right. Stories are so dope in the fact that you may not be able to repeat it word for word perfectly, but you remember enough of the thrust that you can repeat it, you can hand it down. That's how the Bible actually begins. Like, that's what we have. That is the crux of our Christian faith, is the story. And I like to be idyllic and pretend that at some point in ancient history, before the year maybe 320 or so AD, that was the primary, like, focus of the Christian faith before we started really getting down into doctrines and hammering those out. And then that becomes a primary means by which we convey these things. But no, the stories are important, because they'll always communicate truths that our doctrines will struggle to convey.
And stories are also, like, talk about the complexities of life. Like, it's not black or white. It's not just yes and. It's both and it's, stories give space for you to find yourselves within them, so that you're able to discover, where does your truth and your context lie? Like, there's can be different truths from different stories. And so taking the black and whiteness duality out of it is really important too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You talk about, and I don't know what chapter it's in, but I quoted this. I said, you wrote, we learned how to memorize without learning how to meditate. And I just, that resonated with me. Can you talk a little bit about what you meant there? And then where I think you're going with it is, how can Christian leaders, educators, lay people, help individuals and maybe even children today, not necessarily focus on the memorization, but the meditation, or you talk a lot about critical thinking.
Yes. So there are so many ideas about God that people have chiseled out through this thing. I call it the cut and paste method or the collage method. We end up coming up with all of these proof texts to justify all of these ideas, right? Like, if you were to take, for instance, the penal substitutionary theory of atonement, most people who know that by name and defend it ardently, they have a list of proof texts that they'll go to, and they can snap them off and reel them off. I'm like, are you listening to what you're saying? Has it occurred to you that if I were to read these same exact verses without the presupposition that what you're saying about them is true, that I will come away with a different meaning? And if I were to read everything surrounding that verse, it might provide more context than what you're allowing by coming to it with this presupposition, right? And so because we are often hastier to hand down doctrines than stories, we're comfortable mercilessly ripping some of these verses from their context to insist that they say something about God that the story might not be saying when we leave it in context. We memorize these verses as if that shows how serious we are about pursuing God, when there are so many opportunities for us to read these stories, these poems, these letters, these questions, these wrestlings, and meditate on what somebody might have been going through, right? We think, because some people believe that this is the word of God in a way that God has possess somebody to write these exact words, that somehow the humanity has been removed from the situation and we don't have to wrestle with that aspect because we're hearing directly from God. Where when we're talking about the word of God, people are wrestling with real life circumstances. What were they going through, right? What would somebody have gone through in order to pen a psalm asking that God might dash the children of their enemies against the rocks? What might have inspired a prayer like that? What might have inspired someone to argue back and forth in the Bible and say, like, no, like, faith without works is dead. Like, you say that we need faith, but I won't know your faith until what I see you do. How do I know what you believe in until I see how you live and all of these things? And when we meditate on the actual words, I think we learn more about what is being communicated about God than when we're just really good at scripture recall.
Do you get pushback on that in any of your spaces or?
Never. Not a day. Yes. All the time. Yeah. And as one of the things, I recognize that I am uniquely suited to take pushback on a lot of things because I'm largely, and some of this I come by honestly, because of who my father was and because of who my mother is, I am a pretty confident person. And so I'm not impacted by pushback. I could take it. We can dialogue about it. But yeah, there are lots of people, and I understand why, because some of these things I say and I will critique, and it feels as though I am insulting or calling the tradition that you've inherited into question. And the truth of the matter is I am. That is what I'm here to do. Not to denigrate it, but to get people to consider whether or not there is more to God than what we've inherited. And if there is anything to gain by questioning the boundaries of what it was that we were given. And so, like, I grew up and I was a Bible quiz champion, all that stuff. Like, I had to memorize a bunch of scriptures. But I realized at a certain point that, oh, I don't really know anything about this book. Like, I know what's in it, but I don't know anything about the book. I don't know how the Bible came to be. I never thought about what it means that there are different authors in the Bible. I never thought about what it means that there is like a 1500 year period between the first of these words being penned and the last of them being penned. I never thought about it. I don't know this book like I thought I did. When I got to a point where I said, oh, this is actually important. Like, knowing some of these things is important. These will help me to understand what these people are communicating about God. Not everybody comes to that realization at the same time as me. And so as I'm encouraging people, it can be discomforting. And I know that. But I also recognize that the term growing pains exists for a reason. Sometimes growth has to happen in discomfort, that there is a pressure that comes with growing larger.
Yeah, you start to tug a little bit at the string there, and you know, people get nervous, but the growth doesn't happen unless we're uncomfortable.
Right.
And I think, like, there is growth that comes in respectful disagreement or respectful seeing the world in different ways, and that everybody can, like, be shaped and changed or challenged in different ways like that too, right? Like, I was a pastor for a long time, and would get questioned after sermons. And I had sometimes go back and think, like, was that the, like, not in like a self-deprecating way, but in like, could I have said that in a different way? Could I have meant that? Like, I look back at my first sermon and I'm just like, oh my God, like, right. I could have done that better. Right. So just thinking about letting my ego down enough to know that, like, I can also grow and change in those ways too.
Yeah. I don't believe in false humility, right? Like, I think the humility is telling the truth about yourself. And one of the things that I know is that I'm a pretty good communicator. I'm good at thinking something and finding a way to get that point across. And at the same time, where the humility comes in is I'm not vain enough to believe that everything that I believe and all the points that I want to get across represent the totality of who or what God is. I will get a lot of this stuff wrong before it's all said and done. I don't know is the sign of like, if somebody can answer a question with, I don't know, that's a wise person who can say that. Let's agree to disagree is a sign of a healthy community, right? These are all like good places to be when we are able to name the things that we do not know, when we are able to be in community with people that we disagree with on certain particulars. Of course, there are some disagreements that, like, no, we need to reconcile this or go our separate ways. But there's also, like, one of the things that I appreciate, I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of holy envy, right? Like this. I really love the way that Jewish people are able to exist in community with people like, oh, no, you know, we don't agree on this and that's fine, right? And in many Christian communities, we don't really value that in that same way. Like, we really value conformity. Like, no, this is what we believe. And I'm like, no, that's what you believe. I believe something different, right?
That is so true. Yes, yes. That's what people need to get right there.
Well, and that you can stay in the conversation. That it's like, okay, we come at this in different ways, but I see you, I love you, I stay in the conversation. I don't need to just cut ties and walk away, right? Like, that's what Christians tend to do.
Right, right, right.
Well, and that kind of lends itself into, you know, one of the things that we contacted you about and talked about is the shame chapter was a little challenging for both of us because we have seen shame in a very different lens. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about that chapter with you and just, you know, hear your voice and get your story on that. How did that chapter come about and where does that come from for you?
Yeah, it was important for me to talk about shame because shame and religion, those are two words that pop up a lot in Christianity and carry very different connotations for different people, right? Like, there are people who say that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. And implicit in that is that there is something negative about religion. And I get why, because religion has been behind a lot of harm throughout the ages. But at the same time, religion is a natural part of most societies. Religion is merely how we talk about significant things. It's the significance that we're ascribing to story, signs, and people. And because Christianity has been the dominant religion in the world's landscape for centuries and centuries at this point, like, there are some heavy things that are put in there. But I'm not only a student of Christianity, I'm a student of religion and how those function in societies all over the place. And so there's not necessarily a negative connotation there, but I recognize the baggage that comes with. And in a similar way, shame has been weaponized against so many different people that we understandably shirk at the very mention of the word. Like, oh no, there's nothing positive about this. But my belief is that there is a healthy concept of shame that is necessary for a society where mutual accountability is a thing, right? A primary example of this is that every 4th of July, we celebrate the United States of America, and we talk about our rich history and Judeo-Christian values, and it's perfectly fine to celebrate everything that America represents, but we often lack a sense of shame about all of the horrible things that America has done, that all that it took for America to become who and what it is, that without the ethnic cleansing and the genocide of Native peoples, we would not be who we are, that without the free and stolen forced labor of millions of African descendants, we would not be who we are. We're right now in the process of banning books and calling all sorts of people revisionists when things like that are pointed out. And I said, oh, we're shameless, right? If you go to Germany right now, there is a national shame about what transpired during the Holocaust. There's not much of a national equivalent here. There are pockets of people trying to preserve certain things, but, like, nationally, we've mostly agreed that, oh, that's in the past. That's not important to who we are right now. And I think that's harmful because when that is absent, we lose some of the tools available to us in order to strive to be better than we once were. That's the case that I make for shame, is that when shame is weaponized against people, right? When it's not born out of mutual accountability and striving for a better us, that it is misplaced, that is a bad form of shame, and we need to get rid of that. But when shame is that which reminds us of the concept of Ubuntu, right? I am because we are, this collective responsibility that we have for us. When shame is ground in the universality of humanity and the responsibility that we bear to each other to take care of this creation, the one and only creation that God gave us, that's something that we need to hold on to, right? Shame is that thing where when I was out in the streets, like really wilding, and I was like, wow, my parents raised me better than this. I need to chill out. That's a healthy shame. Like that feeling of responsibility that I had with the people who bore the same last name as me, that's healthy. Now, if on the other hand, I am feeling ashamed because my dialect is a little bit different, like, no, that's a society that's an expectation that somebody placed on me without my permission. I didn't ask to belong to this group. I'm being held to a standard that I didn't ask to be a part of. And you'll never let me meet it. That's unhealthy shame. But when we can get together as a people and agree that this is who we want to be, this is what we want to strive toward. And when you don't, like this is holding us back. I think that's a healthy part of a society, personally.
And maybe this is the middle-aged white woman, because I probably had too much Brene Brown in me. It's funny, like I agree with everything you're saying. It's just, I think the word, like I would just not use that word, but I see what you're saying, like it makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's actually fair. Like, and I had a conversation with somebody about this recently. I'm perfectly fine if we need to come up with different language for everything I just described because of the baggage that comes with it, right? I'm a black man, I'm 33 years old, I'm writing a demographic where a lot of my contemporaries, we say the N-word a lot, right? And there are people, older people and black people in our generation said, no, you should never use that word. I'm like, oh, the baggage is just not the same for us. Like it is different. And I understand what their argument is. I'll make sure that the word is not uttered in their presence because I understand what this is doing to you. And I think that there's warrant in this particular situation. If we got to come up with different language, I'm fine. What I'm more after is the concept. What I'm more after is the mutual accountability there, you know?
Where I get hung up on shame is I think shame can be like shame spiral, right? We very quickly can go from I did something bad to I am bad. And so it's like, how do we differentiate between the like, my worth is tied up in what I do? While still, I totally hear you, like accountability is necessary. And I never thought of collective shame before, because there is this sense of like America, white pride, whatever. But there's also the sense of like, yeah, and we did a lot of like fucked up things. And, you know, we got to take responsibility for that and recognize that actually happened, right? So I had to think about that more. But
I thought the collective shame I had not heard that before in phrased in that way. And like, I know it resonates with me because like, I mean, we just watched, I read Flowers of the Killer Moon, and then I watched the show and I'm like, you know, here again, here's our white people doing a bunch of shitty things, killing people, murder or genocide, like, hello, white people, here we are. And so I get it. Like, I'm like, yeah, like I own that in that space. I'm not shaming myself, but I'm owning the collectiveness of the fact that I come from white people.
Right. And I don't even know, I guess I'm trying to parse like where I land on if there's any such thing as a healthy individual shame. I don't know that there is, right? Well, I guess when the individual shame is bound up in what the expectation is of the collective, right? Like when I'm out there acting a fool, embarrassing my family, like maybe that's kind of, but no, shame, any healthy shame has to be bound in the idea of a collective and in the idea of I am because we are. Like I there is no me without us, and there is no us without me. That's where this is grounded for me. What is obviously and undeniably harmful is the idea that a person or a group of people can shame an individual or a group of people within them for who they are. That's obviously unhealthy. But when the shame is kind of flipped around and no, like I am shaming us for who we can be, like we're better than this, right? And so when you talk about the shame spiral of the differentiation between I am bad because I did something bad or whatever, I think that's important to name. That's why like earlier in our conversation, I mentioned that my point is I always begin in the affirmation. Like your worth is drawn from your breath, from your being, not from what you're doing. We're human beings, not human doings, right? If I want to be a nerd about it. That's where this has to start. Like, oh no, you are not defined by who, like if this becomes a habit for you, obviously becomes tough for us to separate. But there is always like the idea of repentance is the idea that I can always turn away from the path that I'm on. and I still get to be. My worth is not based upon where I find myself on that path. It's the fact that I am still moving in a direction. And so at any given point in time, I think anybody who will be a responsible steward of this collective responsibility and everything will understand the importance of affirmation. I'm a parent of a teenager, and that's really tough because a teenager has largely a child's brain and an adult's body. They have adult urges, and at a certain point, they start looking in the mirror and they see an adult. Sometimes they make adult decisions. They want to make adult decisions, but they don't have adult faculties to make all these decisions. And sometimes those decisions are poor. And one of the things that I have to consistently remind myself as we're correcting and as we're disciplining is to separate the child from the action. That no, I'm frustrated with you right now. I'm frustrated with what you did to that degree. Like that's a healthy shame. Like, no, when you go out, I want you to feel bad about doing this. I don't want you to feel bad about being you. This we need to cut that out, right?
I have two teenagers. I know exactly what you're saying.
Oh, thoughts and prayers. I'm with you, my sister. Yeah. We're gonna make it. Whew.
We could have a whole podcast about that.
There we go. It's gracious sufficient, it's powers made perfect in my weakness. Oh Lord, help me, help me, help me.
Amen.
It's really helpful. And it almost talks like shame is this motivator for you. You see who, it's almost grounded in hope, right? Like you see who we can be. And so this is the mirror held up saying, and you don't want to be this, right? You want to be a nation of people, a community of faith that's grounded in compassion and love and justice. And so it's like saying, this is who we can be.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to put it, is grounded in hope. Anything that we hold on to that is not grounded in hope, we ought to get rid of it.
Yeah.
So what hope do you have? Speaking of hope, what hope do you have for people as they read this book, as they process this book? Like what sticks out for you?
For me, the hope is that people would, one, feel affirmed in the fact that a loving and intentional God created them the way that they are on purpose. The hope is that they would come to know who that God is, that God is not out for a pound of flesh. It's not looking to even the score, but that God in Jesus is made known that God empties God's self in order to take on humanity and to be with us in that journey. That there is nothing wrong about being in community with people so long as we recognize that we know in part and we prophesy in part, and that there is more to God than what we know right now. That the God of the universe exists in the not yet. That all of the thoughts that we have thought about God to this point may be leading us in the right direction, but that's not all there is. That we got to keep on doing this bigger and bigger and bigger until we can't anymore. And the subtitle of the book, Theologizing Bigger, Homilies on Living Freely and Loving Holy. That God's commitment is to your wholeness and to your freedom. And that which does not lead you to a more holistic place, that which places bondage on you instead of cutting them away from you, is not from God. That is my hope, that people would understand these truths and hold them for themselves as the gift of God that it is.
We might not be in Buffalo Wild Wings, but I feel like we just went to church. Thank you for that. It felt like you were speaking blessing over us as I listened to that. And I know our listeners will too. We can never be reminded of that enough. And so the work you're doing is important and necessary, and we're grateful for it.
I really appreciate that in a very real way. And again, I recognize the care that you all have poured into building this safe space. I'm appreciative of you allowing me into this space. And I thank you for those words of encouragement in this place of safety.
If people want to find you or check out what you're up to, where can they connect with you?
So the best place to do it is Pastor Trey 05. If you want to connect with me at any given point in time, at PastorTrey05.com. You'll find all of my social media handles. I'm on Twitter. I'm never calling it that letter. I'm on Threads, Instagram, all the places, really. I've got a TikTok account, a Facebook account. You can follow all of that stuff at PastorTrey05.com. In that same place, you can find out where to buy my book. This will probably end up coming out after Black History Month, I'm imagining. But right now, yeah, there's a sale on Amazon. But you can get it anywhere you can buy books. All of the links are posted on my website as well if you want to know all of the options available to you. You can go over there, find both of the podcasts that I participate in, Three Black Men, Theology, Culture, and the World Around Us, as well as the New Living Translation. You can subscribe to my newsletter, Sundew Move. You can We got merch, as a matter of fact. We got book merch. You can get t-shirts, hoodies, all sorts of stuff. Everything at PastorTrey05.com.
And we'll make sure to put a link in the show notes. So if you're listening and driving, you don't have to stop and pull over, but you can check it out in the show notes. We'll put a link.
We want to make sure people know how to get to you, for sure.
No, I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much, Trey. Hopefully this is one of many future conversations as we continue to work together for the wholeness of ourselves, of each other, of the world. And it's a joy to be in this work alongside of you. So thank you for joining us.
Most definitely. Thank you.
Thank you.